Chapter 57. Giordino's plan for a quick turnaround flight to Gladiator Island was dashed almost from the beginning. After using the Augusta's state-of-the-art satellite communications system to brief Sandecker on board the Glomar Explorer in Hawaii, he contacted air and sea rescue units in both Australia and New Zealand and became the first person to announce the disaster to the outside world. During the remainder of the flight to Hobart, he was continually besieged with requests from high-level government officials and reporters from the news media for accounts of the eruption and assessment of the damage. Upon approaching the capital city of Tasmania, Giordino flew along the steep foothills bordering Hobart, whose commercial district was located on the west bank of the Derwent River. Locating the airport, he called the tower. The flight controllers directed him to set down in a military staging area half a kilometer from the main terminal. He was stunned to see a huge crowd of people milling about the area as he hovered over the landing site. Once he shut down the engine and opened the passenger door, everything was accomplished in an orderly manner. Immigration officials came on board and arranged for his entry into Australia without a passport. Social services authorities took custody of Maeve's young sons, assuring Giordino that as soon as their father was located, they would be placed in his care. Then, as Giordino finally set foot on the ground, half-starved and exhausted almost beyond redemption, he was attacked by an army of reporters shoving microphones under his nose, aiming TV cameras at his face and shouting questions about the eruption. The only question he answered with a smile on his face was to confirm that Arthur Dorset was one of the first casualties of the Holocaust. Finally, breaking free of the reporters and reaching the office of the airport's security police, Giordino called the head of the U.S. consulate, who reluctantly agreed to pay for the refueling of the helicopter, but only for humanitarian purposes. His return flight to Gladiator Island was again delayed when Australia's Director of Disaster Relief asked if Giordino would help out by airlifting food and medical supplies back to the island in the Augusta. Giordino graciously gave his consent and then impatiently paced the asphalt around the helicopter while it was refueled and passenger seats were removed to make more room before the needed provisions were loaded on board. He was thankful when one of the relief workers sent him a bag full of cheese sandwiches and several bottles of beer. To Giorgino's surprise, a car drove up and the driver notified him of Sandecker's imminent arrival. He stared at the driver as if the man were crazy. Only 4 hours had passed since he'd reported to Sandecker in Hawaii. The confusion cleared away as a U.S. Navy F-22A supersonic two-place fighter lined up on the runway and touched down. Giordino watched as the sleek craft, capable of Mach 3+ speeds, taxied over to where he had parked the helicopter. The canopy slid back, and Sandecker, wearing a flight suit, climbed out onto a wing. Without waiting for a ladder, he jumped onto the asphalt. He strode straightaway over to the startled Giordino and locked him in a bear hug. "Albert, you don't know how glad I am to see you." "I wish there were more of us here to greet you," Giordino said sadly. "Useless to stand here consoling ourselves." Sandecker's face was tired and lined. "Let's find Dirk." "Don't you want to change first?" "I'll shed this Star Wars suit while we're in flight. The Navy can have it back when I get around to returning it." Less than 5 minutes later, with 2 metric tons of badly needed supplies tied down in the passenger cargo compartment, they were airborne and heading over the Tasman Sea toward the smoldering remains of Gladiator Island. Relief ships of the Australian and New Zealand navies were immediately ordered to the island with relief supplies and medical personnel. Any commercial ship within 200 nautical miles was diverted to offer any assistance possible at the disaster scene. Astoundingly, the loss of life was not nearly as high as first suspected from the immense destruction. Most of the Chinese laborers had escaped from the path of the firestorm and lava flows. Half the mine supervisors survived, but of Arthur Dorset's 80-man security force, only 7 badly burned men were found alive. Later autopsies showed that most of the dead suffocated from inhaling the ash. By late afternoon, the eruption had substantially diminished in force. Bursts of magma still flowed from the volcano's fissures, but had dwindled to small streams. Both volcanoes were mere shadows of their former bulk. Skaggs had nearly disappeared, leaving only a wide, ugly crater. Winkleman remained as a massive mound less than a third of its former height. The canopy of ash still hovered over the volcanoes as Giordino and Sandecker dropped toward the devastated island. Most of the western side of the landmass looked as if a giant wire scraper had scoured it down to bedrock. The lagoon was a swamp choked with debris and floating pumice. Little remained of Dorset Consolidated's mining operations. What wasn't buried under ash protruded like ruins from a civilization dead for 1,000 years. The destruction of vegetation was practically total. Giordino's heart went cold when he saw no sign of the yacht carrying Pitt and Maeve in the lagoon. The dock was scorched and had sunk in the ash-blanketed water beside the demolished warehouses. Sandecker was horrified. He had had no idea of the scope of the catastrophe. "All those people dead," he muttered. "My fault, all my fault." Giordino looked at him through understanding eyes.
"For every dead inhabitant, there are 10,000 people who owe you their lives." "Still," Sandecker said solemnly, his voice trailing off. Giordino flew over a rescue ship that had already anchored in the lagoon. He began decreasing his airspeed in preparation for setting down in a space cleared by Australian Army engineers who had parachuted onto the disaster scene first. The rotor's downwash raised huge billows of ash, obscuring Giordino's view. He hovered and slowly worked the collective pitch and cyclic control in coordination with the throttle. Flying blind, he settled the Augusta and touched down with a hard bump. Drawing a deep breath, he sighed as the rotors wound down. The ash cloud had hardly dissipated when a major in the Australian Army, dusted from head to toe and followed by an aide, ran up and opened the entry door. He leaned in the cargo compartment as Sandecker made his way aft. "Major O'Toole," he introduced himself with a broad smile. "Glad to see you. You're the first relief craft to land."
"Our mission is twofold, Major," said Sandecker. "Besides carrying supplies, we're looking for a friend who was last seen on Arthur Dorset's yacht."
O'Toole shrugged negatively.
"Probably sunk. It'll be weeks before the tides clean out the lagoon enough for an underwater search."
"We were hoping the boat might have reached open water."
"You've had no communication from your friend?"
Sandecker shook his head.
"I'm sorry, but chances seem remote that he escaped the eruption."
"I'm sorry, too." Sandecker stared at something about 1,000,000 kilometers away and seemed unaware of the officer standing by the door. Then he pulled himself together.
"Can we give you a hand unloading the aircraft?"
"Any help will be greatly appreciated. Most of my men are out rounding up survivors."
With the assistance of one of O'Toole's officers, the boxes containing food, water, and medical supplies were removed from the cargo compartment and piled some distance from the helicopter. Failure and sadness stilled any words between Giordino and Sandecker as they returned to the cockpit in preparation for the return flight to Hobart. Just as the rotors began to rotate, O'Toole came running up, waving both hands excitedly. Giordino opened his side window and leaned out.
"I thought you should know," O'Toole shouted above the engine exhaust. "My communications officer just received a report from a relief ship. They sighted a derelict boat drifting approximately 24 kilometers northwest of the island."
The distress in Giordino's face vanished.
"Did they stop to investigate for survivors?"
"No. The derelict was badly damaged and looked deserted. The captain rightly assumed his first priority was to reach the island with a team of doctors."
"Thank you, Major." Giordino turned to Sandecker. "You heard?"
"I heard," Sandecker snapped impatiently. "Get this thing in the air."
Giordino required no urging. Within 10 minutes of lifting off, they spotted the yacht almost exactly where the captain of the relief ship reported it, wallowing dead amid the marching swells. She rode low in the water with a 10-degree list to port.
Her topsides looked as if they had been swept away by a giant broom. Her once proud sapphire-blue hull was scorched black, and her decks wore a heavy coating of gray ash. She had been through hell, and she looked it. "The helicopter pad looks clear," commented Sandecker. Giordino lined up on the stern of the yacht and made a slow, slightly angled descent. The sea showed no sign of white, indicating a mild wind factor, but the yacht's roll and its list made his landing tricky. He reduced power and hovered at an angle matching that of the yacht, timing his drop for when the yacht rose on the crest of a wave. At the exact moment, the Augusta flared out, hung for a few seconds, and sank to the sloping deck. Giordino immediately applied the brakes to keep the aircraft from rolling into the sea and shut down the engine. They were safely down, and their thoughts now turned to fear of what they might find. Giordino jumped out first and quickly fastened tie-down ropes from the helicopter to the deck. Hesitating for a moment to draw their breath, they stepped across the charred deck and entered the main salon. One look at the two inert figures huddled in one corner of the room, and Sandecker shook his head despairingly. He briefly closed his eyes tight, fighting a wave of mental anguish. So awesome was the cruel scene, he couldn't move. There was no sign of life. Grief tore at his heart. He stared motionless in sad bewilderment. They both had to be dead, he thought. Pitt was holding Maeve in his arms. The side of his face was a mask of dried blood from the injury inflicted by Boudicca. The whole of his chest and side were also stained dark crimson. The charred clothes, the eyebrows and hair that had been singed away, the burns on his face and arms, all gave him the image of someone horribly maimed in an explosion. He looked like he'd died hard. Maeve seemed as though she had died, not knowing her sleep would be eternal. A waxen sheen on her lovely features, she reminded Sandecker of a white, unburned candle, a sleeping beauty no kiss would ever awake. Giordino knelt down beside Pitt, refusing to believe his old friend was dead. He gently shook Pitt's shoulder.
"Dirk, speak to me, buddy."
Sandecker tried to pull Giordino away.
"He's gone," he said in a saddened whisper.
Then, with such unexpectedness that both men were frozen in shock and disbelief, Pitt's eyes slowly opened. He stared up at Sandecker and Giordino, not understanding, not recognizing. His lips quivered, and then he murmured,
"God forgive me. I lost her."